Lawmakers are moving fast with new bills on police reform, changing the Constitution to get more tax dollars for mining and mail-in ballots. Bert Johnson is KNPR's legislative reporter, and he's been following the second special session of the summer. Bert, welcome back.
Thanks, Joe.
So, Bert, since the session began Friday, what's happened?
Well, over the weekend, the Senate passed a measure that would allow the courts to pause eviction cases for 30 days. Senate Bill 1 would make it so tenants and landlords could meet with an arbitrator and settle things instead of going straight to court. The eviction moratorium expires September 1st, and the Gwynn Center just released a report predicting that more than 250,000 people in the state could be affected. So Nevada Supreme Court Justice Jim Hardesty told senators this reform would help courts deal with that wave of evictions. He said if the predictions are even close to accurate, it'll mean more than three times the number of cases they usually see in a full year, and that could happen basically all at once. Hardesty said that'd just overwhelm the courts.
So this bill is supposed to help things by going to arbitration instead of court. But if people without jobs because of COVID-19 can't pay, how will this help?
Well, it could help renters who lost work. This would give them an opportunity to come up with a payment plan, for example, if they're now back at work. They could use that extra time to catch up without getting kicked out. But the arbitration could also help landlords, because if you have a bunch of cases jamming up the courts, it could take a really long time to get through them all. And a lot of those landlords wouldn't be getting rent anyway while they wait for their case to be heard. So if they can come to an arrangement, it would be a win-win. And it would also give tenants time to apply for the state's $30 million rental assistance program.
Now, you said this bill passed in the Senate. What about the Assembly?
They still haven't voted on it yet, but it got bipartisan support when it did pass in the Senate, so it looks like it'll pass the Assembly, too.
So that might help people who are facing potential evictions when the eviction moratorium ends September 1st. What else have been legislators working on?
Well, another big topic they're looking at is police reform. Joe, you interviewed some of the folks who have been pushing for this on the show last month. They want to see changes in use of force policies, along with greater transparency and accountability from police.
And people have been pushing for change after police killed George Floyd in Minneapolis, but we've had controversial deaths at the hands of police here as well. Mikia Lee in Sparks and Byron Williams in Las Vegas. What are some of the changes that lawmakers are looking at?
Well, the first one is Assembly Bill 3, which would ban police from using chokeholds. It had also required departments to share data on traffic stops and other interactions with the public, and it says people have the right to film police officers while they're on duty.
Would that data, the traffic stop data, that would that include racial data, which is something Jason Frierson has wanted?
You know, I haven't seen the specifics on that yet, but it seems like it's designed to essentially do that, yeah. And that would send the data directly to the state.
And the part about filming police officers while they're on duty, isn't that already protected by the First Amendment?
Well, yeah, it is. But this explicitly adds it to state law. They're also looking at another bill, Senate Bill 2, which reverses some parts of the Peace Officers Bill of Rights, also known as SB 242, which the legislature just approved during the last regular session. One of the big things this reform would do is allow people to get access to police officer statements about use of force incidents during lawsuits. That was something that was blocked by that last bill. Advocates say that was a big step back in terms of transparency.
And Northern Nevada Senator Ira Hansen has said to even look at police reform is very unusual during the special session. Is it that unusual?
Well, Fred Locken, political science professor at Truckee Meadows Community College, seems to agree with Hansen.
I think it's a matter of timing. You know, with a part-time legislature, we only have one shot at it every other year, and that can be extremely frustrating. I mean, for those sitting here, seeing what other states have been able to enact already, and technically having to wait until February to even begin the conversation.
Basically, this is the kind of thing they usually deal with during the regular session, but there's just so much public pressure right now. I think they feel like they have to address it.
And another area they are supposed to deal with is the general election in November. Sounds like they've gotten to that. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. Both houses approved a plan yesterday to send mail-in ballots to every active registered voter in the state. The governor is expected to sign it into law at the end of the session. Assembly Bill 4, which is the new reform, creates a new category of elections, actually, called affected elections. And those happen after the governor or the legislature declares a state of emergency, like Governor Sisolak did for COVID-19. Once that happens, the state automatically sends out those mail ballots, and they're very similar to a normal absentee ballot, except you get one automatically as long as you voted in one of the last two elections. Otherwise, they'll try to remind people to re-register.
So, will there be any in-person voting?
Most definitely. County and state governments are going to have to provide polling places under this bill, too. And tribal governments will also have the option to do that. And there's also an option to use a drop-off box with your ballot if you want to do it that way. People will also be able to register to vote on election day at their polling place. And AB 4 sets a minimum number of polling places because there weren't enough of them during the June primary. And some people ended up having to wait for hours to vote.
So it's going to create something like we had in the June primary.
It would be really similar. Back then, you know, the state sent mail-in ballots to voters so they wouldn't be exposed to COVID-19. This is essentially doing the same thing. And by the way, voter turnout went up as compared to the 2016 primary. So in Washoe County, for example, it was about 10% higher. I talked to Emily Persaud Zamora, who's executive director of Silver State Voices. She thinks AB4 is a victory for voting rights.
When we provide ballots to Nevada voters via their mailbox with paid postage, it increases their ability to participate in the election.
But this bill only made it through on a party line vote. No Republicans voted for it. And she told me that was really disappointing because voter engagement shouldn't be a partisan issue.
I'm talking to Bert Johnson. If you're just joining us, we are going over the second special session of the summer. A lot of huge issues are being tackled during this session. The governor's given them until Friday, although that could be extended if needed. And now joining us is Steve Sebelius of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He joins us via Skype. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Steve, you know, that voting reform bill, we obviously already had mail-in balloting. Why would you introduce a new law?
Well, I think the what happened with the existing law was it was sort of bootstrapped to apply to the situation that we found ourselves in with the coronavirus. And I think the state wanted something more explicitly on the books so that to say, if this situation or a similar situation happens again, then we will have procedures in place to do it. I also think the reluctance of the Secretary of State, Barbara Sagaski, who said in our newspaper that she didn't think there was a need to do a mail-in election in November, that it was safe to do it in person. I think that had something to do with it as well.
Why do you think she said that?
I think she really believes it. You know, she goes out and says, look, I see people at the mall. I see people going to restaurants and bars. You know, we're wearing masks. We're taking precautions. But the state is opening up. And so if the state is opening up and you can wait in line, you know, at other places, you can go safely to the polls and do it. I think she really believes that. Plus, she got a lot of criticism, both left and right, for doing a mail-in election in the primary. There were lawsuits and allegations that she had kowtowed to Democrats in doing that. I don't think that criticism is very fair. I think she did a good job in the primary election. But she wanted to get back to a traditional in-person election. And I think Democrats in the legislature worried that she might not facilitate the mail-in election the way she did in the primary. And so they felt the law was needed, and it was needed quickly because we're about to print the ballots and we've got to get things aligned before we do that.
You know, at the national level, political pundits are saying President Trump doesn't like mail-in balloting because he thinks it will give a voting advantage to Democrats. Is that part and parcel of the Republicans in our legislature argument against it?
Well, I think statistically, the more people who vote, the better Democrats do. So to the extent that mail voting facilitates a higher turnout, then, yeah, I think there's something for the Republicans to worry about there. Is it a big plot? You know, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there's very many legitimate arguments against saying we want the largest number of people who are eligible, registered voters, to turn out and vote on Election Day. I don't think there's a lot of good arguments against that. If you're arguing against turnout, if your strategy depends on suppressing rather than increasing turnout, I think you've got a problem that has nothing to do with the voting systems and more to do with your campaign and your platform and your turnout mechanism.
You know, money is a big issue because the state is bringing in very little due to COVID-19. And a lot of Nevadans thought the legislature would do something during the first special session about how little the mining industry is taxed in Nevada. They didn't do anything, but they are doing something now.
They tried. They tried.
They did try. But what are they doing now? What is it?
Well, now is a little bit different. You need two-thirds to do what they wanted to do in the former special session, which is adjust the deductions that mining takes against its net proceeds of minerals. Now you've got three different constitutional amendments, which can be approved by a simple majority, that essentially say we're going to change the rate from 5 to 7.75%, or we're going to change the rate on the net to the local property tax not to exceed 12%, and here's how we're going to spend the money. So all three of those proposals have been approved. They now go to the Secretary of State, where they'll wait until the next session. Lawmakers will take them up the next session. If they approve them there, they go to the voters. So that can be done without a two-thirds majority, and so I think that's how they're going to plan to do this. Mining has been in the Constitution and protected in the Constitution since it was written by miners. So tinkering with it, I think now is something that appeals to Democrats, not so much to Republicans. They are lockstep against any of that, which is not surprising because the majority in the Republican caucus in both Assembly and Senate come from northern Nevada and rural Nevada, and that's where mining is big industry.
Now, these are resolutions. They have to be approved several different times. So it seems like the money isn't going to be coming in for quite some time, or am I wrong about that? What has to happen now?
No, you're not wrong about that. It does take a process. Normally, it takes about 5 years. We're actually going to get a jump on it because we're doing it in a special session now. It'll go to the 2021 legislature, where if it gets approved then, it will go to the ballot in 2022. Normally, if we didn't have this special session now, you'd have to propose it in 2021. Then again in 2023, it would come back, and it wouldn't get to the voters till 2024. So we're actually ahead of the game, shaving 2 years off the process by approving it in this special session.
Yet another issue they're tackling, the state's unemployment system, which has been a mess during the pandemic. They can't keep up with demand. There are likely fraudulent payments going out. Two separate department heads resigned, one who received death threats. So the Senate has a bill, SB3, that would create some changes. What would it do?
Well, it would. There's a lot of things in this bill. There would be waivers of certain regulations. You could send documents via email as opposed to being regular mail. There would be ways for them to speed up the process, essentially. I think most lawmakers said on the floor last night it was a good first step, but it's not going to fix the problem, and it's not going to go and get rid of the backlog. To the extent that staff is relieved of having to deal with some of these burdensome procedures now, it'll help with the backlog, but it's not going to erase the horrible problems that we've really seen. And there were some heartbreaking stories that were told in that testimony. But I think Senator Heidi Gansert of Reno really said it best. She said, look, when the casinos started shutting down, when the governor started shutting down businesses by his executive orders because of the emergency, we should have known unemployment was going to go through the roof, and we should have done something at that point to start dealing with it. And I find that very compelling. I think she's absolutely right about that. We didn't do that. And as a result, our system, which is always not really well-funded and well-staffed, was completely overwhelmed. And you see the terrible results of people not being able, even now, to get unemployment who filed months ago.
But it doesn't sound like they're getting at that issue, the administration issue. They're doing something. This seems like a quick fix. Is there anything? Chris June Kiliani was on with us last week saying they need to do something, you know, to fix that system as a whole. Nothing like that seems to be coming.
No, not a wholesale reorganization of DITR. Nothing that would make a systemic change that would say, look, in the future, if we see an unusual rise in unemployment claims, we have these mechanisms at our disposal. You know, we can immediately go out and hire a call center that's been trained and able to help people get their unemployment. Nothing like that. And she's right. She's absolutely right. Chris June Kiliani is absolutely right. Longtime state lawmaker. She's seen the system from the inside. And we do need to do something like that, because what's going on now, I don't think is acceptable to anybody. You saw bipartisan support for that bill in the committee of the whole. It was processed out unanimously. That's rare in this special session, Joe, mm-hmm. to get a unanimous vote. There hasn't been a unanimous vote on many of these bills, but on that one, everybody agreed we got to get going on this.
You know, these issues that we're talking about so far, police reform, eviction notices, unemployment, they're moving pretty quickly. But the one that seems to be more contentious and that could hold things up, I think, is the COVID-19 liability protection for businesses and government. What's really briefly, what's that about?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is exactly what delayed the start of the special session. And that is the one bill that was called for in the governor's proclamation that has yet to be introduced. Now, the RJ obtained a BDR, and we put that out over the weekend of what this would be. Essentially, this says if there are health rules and if you follow them as a business, you will be able to be exempt from lawsuits that allege that, hey, I went to your business and got COVID-19. You'll be exempt from that if you follow the rules. If you don't, you don't enjoy the protection. That's essentially what it is. Now, obviously, there's a lot of details that need to be worked out on this, and workers are not happy about some of these provisions because they want better protections in the law, especially members of the culinary union they've lost. It's not over 20 now, I hope, but they've lost members to COVID-19. So they're not happy about this. And I think workers generally are going to have a problem on it. That bill has yet to be introduced, Joe. We're now, you know, well into the special session, and we only have seen a BDR, no bill.
So a BDR, do you have any idea, you know, from your sources about what might be coming?
Well, I think they're still, even though they have draft language in that bill draft request that I mentioned, I think they're still rounding up the votes, because while I'm told the governor is very supportive of this legislation, he wants this legislation. Certainly the state's business and casino industries want this legislation. He's having trouble finding the votes in the Democratic caucus. This is an intra-party fight. There are some Democrats, especially on the progressive side, that say, no, we are not going to give business carte blanche because we don't think they'll follow the rules. And giving them liability is outrageous at a time like this. So that fight is going on. It's going on almost exclusively on the Democratic side, because, trust me, the Republicans will definitely vote out liability reform, immunity, if you will, once it comes out. But I think they're still gathering the votes that they're going to need to support it. Ultimately, I think it will pass, Joe.
I want to go back to something regarding police reform. This is an issue that is very graspable to most people, you know, because of the George Floyd, because of the protests here, and because of the desire of so many people to do something about how police interact with people. What interesting, I don't know if it was in your newspaper or some other newspaper, I read that last line of a story, that the police reform bill was basically written with the help of a lobbyist for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I read that. I thought those days were sort of gone. Years ago, there were stories about lobbyists running bills between the governor's office and the state house, and it drew a lot of criticism. But I wonder if the fact that lobbyists are in on the writing of these things, if it's a sign that our term-limited lawmakers can't do the job as well.
Well, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, lobbyists are involved a lot of the time in writing bills, not writing the text, but drafters will go to and sponsors will go to lobbyists and say, hey, is this, you know, how would we do this? What's the proper way to do this? And certainly, when you talk about the police, that we're talking about a bifurcated system, right? There's lobbyists for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, which represent the administration. And then there's lobbyists for the Las Vegas Police Protective Association, the union. I guarantee you, those groups of lobbyists will have a very different view about police reform, depending on which side that they're on. But look, our legislature is a phenomenally weak legislature. They meet only part-time or in special session. They don't have necessarily the time or expertise or staff, which is key, staff, to be able to research and write these bills in such a way that they can't or don't need to rely on lobbyists. So that goes on still to this day, Joe, and it goes on with all sorts of legislation, not just this.
Isn't that dangerous for Nevada, given that, you know, the state's budget is getting massive, more people are moving here? It just seems sort of, I don't know, it doesn't seem like a good way to operate things.
Well, I agree with you on that, and I have said on more than one occasion that these constant special sessions, we've now had as many special sessions in the last 20 years as we have had in the first 130 some odd years of Nevada's statehood. It just goes to show we do need a full-time legislature. We need a legislature that meets every single year for no other reason than to adjust the budget to whatever the current economic conditions are. But doing that, having a full-time staff, being able to research and come up with best practices and figure out how to write these bills would reduce the reliance on lobbyists to do that. But sometimes, you know, these lobbyists who've had experience in legislation for many years are the best source of that information, and they have to be relied upon to help.
That's Steve Sebelius. He's politics and government editor for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Also with us, Bert Johnson. He is State of Nevada's legislative reporter. Steve and Bert, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Glad to be here.
Thanks.